Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the IPRO Surgical Care Improvement Project Heart Failure Initiative Conference Call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require operator assistance during the conference, please press star, then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this conference call is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your host for today's presentation, Ms. Denise Faulkner-Cameron. Ms. Faulkner-Cameron, you may begin, ma'am.
Thank you, Howard, and good morning to you all again, and thank you for taking time out on this cloudy, rainy Friday morning to join us for our fourth conference call as part of the Surgical Care Improvement Project and Heart Failure Initiative for the ninth scope of work with CMS. Before we get started, I just want to remind everyone that the materials for this morning's call have been posted to Jenny and a link sent out to all of our participating hospitals. However, if you have not yet had a chance to download them, I'll give you an opportunity to do so now. Simply log on to our community online forum, Jenny at jeny.ipro.org. And when you get to the Jenny main page, there's a forum called Discussion Topics. And the third line is IPRO QIO Initiative. Click on that. And then click on the Skip Heart Failure Initiative for 2008. The password for the forum is STRIVE, STRIVE, all lower cases. And then simply click on the link entitled Skip Heart Failure Conference Call Materials for June 5th, 2009. And just to let you know, the materials included are a slide set for the performance improvement team from St. Francis Hospital that we're going to hear from later on in the call, as well as two of their tools and resources that they're sharing with us that is also going to be reviewed as part of their presentation. And then the last document is an evaluation form that we're going to remind you to please take a few moments and fill out at the conclusion of the call. So we're pleased to once again have featured on our call a clinical champion and the performance improvement team from St. Francis Hospital, a designated heart center in Roslyn, New York. And our clinical champion, who is Dr. Rory Stephen Breithart, is going to provide us some clinical background on the skip infection 4 indicator, which is looking at cardiac surgery patients with control serum glucose, 6 a.m. serum glucose control. And then we will hear from Maureen Goss and the performance improvement team, who's going to share some of their best practices for compliance and improvement on this indicator. So before I turn the call over to Dr. Breithart, I just wanted to give you a little background on him. Dr. Breithart is the chief of the Division of Endocrinology at St. Francis Hospital. He is also the medical director of the outpatient diabetes clinic at St. Francis Hospital, as well as a clinical instructor in medicine at New York University School of Medicine. He received his medical degree from the Tel Aviv University Sackler School of Medicine and completed his residency in internal medicine at the Long Island Jewish Medical Center. He is certified by the American Board of Internal Medicine and the Subspecialty Board of Endocrinology. Among his many roles, also includes co-leader of the care of the Diabetic Patient Performance Improvement Committee. And among the honors that he's received, he was chosen as Physician of the Year by the Metropolitan New York Association of Diabetes Educators. And Dr. Breithart's affiliations include the American Medical Association, the American College of Physicians, as well as the American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists. So it's my pleasure to present to you Dr. Rory Stephen Breithart.
Thank you very much. Thank you, everyone, for calling in. I'd just like to preface my remarks in the beginning by saying that much of what I'm about to say can be found in a recent consensus statement on inpatient diabetes management published in the May issue of Endocrine Practice. So diabetes is a disease that crosses all specialties. It's unlikely that anyone taking care of inpatients has not come across diabetes in one way or another. Approximately 22% of all hospital inpatient days were incurred by people with diabetes at a cost of about $87 billion. This represents about half of the $174 billion that the United States spends on diabetes each year. The fact that we have all seen diabetes, that it represents such a large part of our inpatient population, and that its costs are so high, is due in part to the worldwide epidemic of type 2 diabetes. In the United States alone, there are approximately 1.6 million new cases of diabetes each year. The most current estimates are that 23.6 million Americans have diabetes, which represents about 7.8% of the American population, about 25% of these cases being undiagnosed. Another 57 million people are felt to be at risk for type 2 diabetes. Up until about 2004, diabetes was considered by most to be a biochemical abnormality. People knew that high sugar was bad, but there were no clear guidelines on when or how to treat inpatient hyperglycemia. Observational evidence began to mount linking hyperglycemia in inpatients that includes patients with and without diabetes to poor outcomes. Cohort studies, as well as a few early randomized control trials, suggested that intensive treatment of hyperglycemia improved hospital outcomes. This led to a consensus conference in 2004 with the American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists and the American Diabetes Association and other organizations to develop recommendations for the treatment of inpatient hyperglycemia. The recommendations endorsed tight glycemic control, approximately 80 to 110, in critical care units. For patients in general medical and surgical units, there were no randomized controlled trials, and targets similar to outpatients were recommended. So everything was going along really well, and inpatient diabetes control became a real issue in hospitals, and in particular in critical care units. Inpatient glycemic control teams were formed, and endocrinologists became a key part of the care of the critically ill. Different institutions began to publish their protocols describing how they achieved glycemic targets, and guidelines were formatted that set benchmarks for inpatient glucose control. Then what happened? Although we know that hyperglycemia is associated with poor outcomes, interventions to normalize glucoses have yielded inconsistent results. Recent trials in critically ill patients have failed to show a significant improvement in mortality with intensive glycemic control, and some have shown an increased risk of mortality. These studies have also shown the risk of severe hypoglycemia as we try to achieve normal glucoses. The results of these studies have contributed to the confusion regarding specific glycemic targets and the means of achieving them in both critically ill and non-critically ill patients. So how can we summarize the results of recent trials? Although very tight glycemic control, about 80 to 110, was beneficial in a predominantly surgical ICU population, this target has been difficult to achieve in subsequent studies without increasing the risk for severe hypoglycemia. Also, there has been no specific mortality reduction with tight control, and the largest study so far showed an increase in mortality. The reasons for these inconsistencies are not entirely clear. Just because there are inconsistencies in the data, we should not throw away the idea of good glycemic control. One reason is that we definitely know that hyperglycemia is associated with poor outcomes. We also know that the risk of hypoglycemia is unacceptably high with our present targets. The risk can be lowered by both a reduction in the targets as well as improved and carefully implemented protocols. The key concept is to continue to emphasize the importance of good glycemic control while aiming for targets less stringent than 80 to 110. So what are the new targets? The latest evidence suggests that glucoses in the ICU should be no higher than 180. If glucoses exceed 180, intravenous insulin should be used to keep glucoses between 140 and 180. Targets less than 110 are not recommended. The use of protocols with proven safety, efficacy, and low incidence of hypoglycemia is encouraged. In non-critically ill patients, there are no good studies to guide us. For the majority of non-critically ill patients treated with insulin, prenatal glucose targets should generally be less than 140 and random glucose levels less than 180. For avoidance of hypoglycemia, consideration should be given to reassessing the insulin regimen if glucoses decline below 100, and regimen should definitely be reassessed for glucoses less than 70 unless the event can be easily explained, like a missed meal. Having said this, there may be certain exceptions to the rule. Clinically stable patients who are tightly controlled as outpatients may continue their tight control. Also, higher glucoses may be acceptable in the terminally ill, in patients with severe comorbidities, as well as those patients in settings where frequent glucose monitoring or close nursing supervision is not feasible. I'd now like to review some definitions. The definition of hyperglycemia is defined as a glucose greater than 140. Levels significantly and persistently above this level may need treatment. For inpatients without a prior history of diabetes, a hemoglobin A1C of greater than 6.5 to 7 suggests that diabetes preceded the hospitalization. Hypoglycemia is a glucose less than 70. This is the standard definition for outpatients and correlates with the initial threshold for the release of counter-regulatory hormone. Severe hypoglycemia is defined as a glucose less than 40. This value is associated with adverse short-term and long-term outcomes. Early detection of mild to moderate hypoglycemia, the 40 to 69 range, can prevent the severe less than 40 range with its more serious consequences. Now, what treatments do we have available to achieve our goal? Again, speaking about critical care areas, IV insulin has been shown to be the safest and most effective way to achieve specific glycemic targets. The very short half-life of IV insulin allows proper dosing adjustments to address changes in patient status. IV insulin is best administered either by written or computerized protocols that allow for changes in insulin rates based on changes in glucose and insulin dose. Education of all staff with respect to these protocols is key. Patients on IV insulin will generally require a transition to subcutaneous insulin. Again, staff education here is key here so that drips are not stopped without subcutaneous insulin to take its place. For non-ICU patients, subcutaneous insulin has been shown to be the best agent to control hyperglycemia in the hospital. The problem with oral agents is that they have many relative and absolute contraindications that make them hard to use in the hospital. There may, however, be a small number of patients in which the use of oral agents is acceptable, but in general, subcutaneous insulin is the safest and most effective means of achieving good glucose control in the hospital. Subcutaneous insulin is generally made up of three components: basal insulin, supplemental insulin, and correction insulin, and I'll be happy to discuss these three types of insulin later if anyone has any questions. What I would like to talk about is the so-called sliding scale as the sole means of glucose control. For those of you who don't know the term sliding scale, it is a set of insulin orders that delivers insulin only if glucose has exceeded a certain arbitrary threshold. It has been shown time and again to be ineffective at controlling glucose in the majority of patients. It has resulted in unacceptable hyper- and hypoglycemia, and it's potentially dangerous in type 1 diabetes. Now, what about safety? Insulin and oral hypoglycemic agents are potentially dangerous because of the risk of hypoglycemia. We all know that hyperglycemia can be harmful. Recognition of events that can lead to hyper- and hypoglycemia are important, and again, staff education here is key. Some of the most common events are as follows. One, change in calorie intake, either a new NPO status, a patient that's beginning to eat, starting, stopping, or adjusting of enteral and parenteral nutrition. Number two, starting, stopping, or change in steroids. Three, failure of the clinician to make medication adjustments based on glucose. Four, prolonged use of sliding scale insulin as the sole means of glucose control. Five, poor coordination of finger sticks and administration of insulin with meals. Six, poor communication during patient transfer. Seven, the use of long-acting sulfonylureas in elderly patients or those with renal or hepatic insufficiency. And eight, errors in order writing and transcription. A hospital-wide hypoglycemia treatment protocol is very important and will help prevent mild hypoglycemia from becoming severe hypoglycemia. Now, what systems need to be in place to help achieve these goals? First, a multidisciplinary team made up of at least one physician who has experience and interest with inpatient diabetes management. The team should also include representatives from nursing, pharmacy, nutrition, laboratory, mid-level providers, and discharge planning. Second, the use of pre-printed order sheets that should ideally have contingency orders built in, for example, holding prandial insulin if a patient has made NPO. Third, coordination of meal delivery and prandial insulin administration. This can be a major undertaking. The people who deliver the trays must be educated not to deliver diabetic meals directly to the patient. The nurse or a nurse extender must be educated to check the glucose before the patient eats and to convey the results to the nurse immediately so that prandial medication can be given. Dietary and nutrition department should make sure that diabetic trays contain a consistent number of carbohydrates. Fourth, transitioning to the outpatient is another important part of inpatient diabetes management. It is important that all patients have an understanding of diabetes, an understanding of their medications and how to take them, know how and when to perform home glucose monitoring and to follow up with their PCP or endocrinologist. This process can be lengthy, and the earlier in the hospital stay this can be addressed, the better. I would just like to conclude with a few words about cost. Improved glycemic control has been shown in several studies to result in substantial cost savings, primarily attributable to decreases in laboratory, pharmacy, and radiology costs, fewer inpatient complications, decreased ventilator days, and reductions in ICU and hospital length of stay. So with that, I'll conclude my remarks.
Thank you so much, Dr. Brightbird. And I just want to advise all our participants that at the conclusion of the call, at the conclusion of the second presentation, we will open the lines up for questions and answers for both Dr. Brightbird as well as the St. Francis Performance Improvement Team. So at this time, I'll turn the call over to Maureen Gauss, who will introduce the team and go into a discussion of their best practices. Maureen?
Hi, Denise. Good morning, everyone. I'm Maureen Gauss from the Performance Improvement Department. I've spoken to you during the past two St. Francis Hospital presentations. Other members of our PI department are also returning with me today. They are Anna Baricini, AVP of our Performance Improvement Department, Kathy Arnock, Clinical Data Coordinator, former nurse. We are also very fortunate to have members of our hospital's glycemic team who worked with Dr. Rory Breitbart with us, Dr. Carol Bono, manager of the pharmacy department, who has helped us with many core measure items, Dr. Annie Chen, mathematician of DORA, works with DORA, the Department of Operational Research and Analytics, Joan Wallace, nurse manager, and Terry Farkas, PIRN of the Medical ICU Committee. Today's presentation is our third in the past few months. We do not know which of our listeners heard our last presentation, so I will still give you a brief background of St. Francis Hospital before focusing on how we manage glycemic control for our patients. Slide 3. St. Francis Hospital was founded in 1922 by the Franciscan Missionaries of Mary for children with rheumatic heart disease. We are a member of the Catholic Health Services of Long Island and carry out the healing ministry of the Church and the Diocese of Rockville Center. Our mission is built upon our heritage, always emphasizing respect for the dignity of individuals and the compassionate treatment for all. The spirit of people who work at St. Francis Hospital is unique. We are fortunate to have a close group of caregivers, many of whom have lifetime careers here. Caregivers are vested to seeing St. Francis succeed in providing excellent patient care. Keeping our patients is the most important focus. Doing right by the patient is always number one. We must keep this in mind as we have more and more regulations to follow. Dr. Dale Brassler often explains that core measures are not meant for 100% of the population. We need to always do what is medically right for the patient, and the core measure regulations and documentations of contraindications should follow suit, which they most often do. St. Francis Hospital is a magnet-recognized facility known for patient care excellence and recognized as one of the best places to work in New York. U.S. News and World Report named St. Francis Hospital as a leader in cardiac care, digestive disorders, and geriatrics. We are New York State's only specialty-designated cardiac center and offer one of the leading cardiac care programs in the nation, with specialties in heart surgery, cardiac catheterizations, and angioplasty, and the diagnosis and treatment of abnormal heart rhythms. St. Francis Hospital has the latest technology for non-invasive diagnostic imaging and minimally invasive surgery, plus expanding programs in vascular, prostate, ear, nose, throat, orthopedic, and general surgery. St. Francis Hospital also has a comprehensive community health and education program based at the DeMatteis Center for Cardiac Research and Education, located in our nearby, absolutely beautiful town of Old Brookville. We have had tremendous growth over the past year. Our new DeMatteis building expanded clinical space by 40%. We expanded our cardiac cath labs, ORs, critical care beds, and emergency rooms. St. Francis Hospital has a non-teaching structure where nursing communicates directly with the attendings. Mid-level practitioners, which are the PAs and NPs, assist the attendings. We do have students in other disciplines such as nursing and technology. Slide 4. You've heard me say, if you've heard our last presentations, that we are not just a heart center anymore. However, we are a strong designated heart center and do have large numbers of cardiac patients. Last year in 2008, we had about 8,670 cardiac catheterizations, 3,200 PCIs, and 1,575 open hearts, which for those of you who register open heart data, were about 880 CABGs, 370 valves, 280 CABG valves, and about 50 other open heart procedures such as aneurysms. For the past quarter of 2009, we have had about 2,020 cardiac caths, 775 PCIs, and 370 open hearts. Slide 5. The Performance Improvement Department manages core measures at St. Francis Hospital. PI nurses focus on one core measure and are cross-trained in another for backup. We do a retrospective review of a sample of charts chosen by our vendor Midas, which provides us with excellent support and education. Our core measure nurses abstract the charts, enter the information into Midas, pull OFIs, Opportunity for Improvement reports from Midas, and talk to whomever they need to talk to regarding these OFIs. Our PI nurses provide feedback to the involved departments as well as to the medical PI committees. Our core measure nurses attend educational WebExes by our vendor Midas, double-check the OFI charts as part of a PI plan, and have in-office meetings with each other to document, standardize, and improve our abstraction, follow-up, and education. Slide 6. The skip glucose measure is different than our other core measure indicators, which are distinctly defined, such as antibiotics within 1 hour of surgical incision. The skip glucose measure is incorporated into a broader hospital-wide glycemic control program, which focuses on managing both hypoglycemia and hyperglycemia, which is defined by lower limits than skip. An interdisciplinary critical care staff manages glycemic control, and these members include intensivists, mid-level practitioners, RNs, dietitians, clinical nurse specialists, and pharmacists, and physicians. Slide 7, a critical care glycemic control algorithm utilizing a continuous insulin infusion was first implemented at St. Francis Hospital in 2004. On June 14, 2007, this algorithm was adjusted into a Delta protocol based on both the Yale and Portland, Oregon protocols. This new Delta protocol aimed to keep patients in a safe zone of 90 to 119 milligrams per deciliter, accepting up to 140 as a target. The protocol defined hypoglycemia as below 70 and hyperglycemia as greater than 180. In August of 2008, we experienced an increase in hypoglycemic cases. That September, our glycemic PI team addended the Delta protocol to decrease insulin units per hour once patients reached the safe zone of 90 to 119. Patients were then started on continuous insulin infusions at lower rates than when they entered the safe zone. Caregivers monitored finger stick blood glucose hourly on both the Delta protocol and the addendum protocol, and switched patients from the addendum protocol back to the more aggressive Delta protocol if the blood sugar rose above 120. Identifying ways to avoid hypoglycemia was also part of the addendum improvements. About the same time that we were adjusting the Delta protocol, St. Francis Hospital hired a mathematician, Dr. Annie Chen, who is with us today. Dr. Chen studied the results of diabetic and non-diabetic patients during the three already mentioned time periods, pre-Delta, Delta, and the addended Delta time periods. Dr. Chen determined that for the non-diabetic population, hypoglycemia decreased significantly, which is an improvement, in both the initial Delta period and the addendum Delta period. There weren't any significant differences in the incidence of hyperglycemia for this non-diabetic population. For the diabetic population, the incidence of hypoglycemia again decreased, which is an improvement, during the initial Delta period and the addendum Delta period. However, hyperglycemia rates also decreased, which is an improvement, during both these periods for postoperative day one only. Efforts to support glycemic control are enacted throughout the hospital. We had a diabetic patient PI team from 2004 through 2008. This team was chartered to promote effective glycemic control of diabetic and non-diabetic patients, identify barriers to effective glycemic control, develop educational programs, develop a transition protocol, IV to sub-Q, still in development, further development, standardize hypoglycemia management, promote the accuracy of fasting blood sugars and bedside glucose testing, and reduce potential for insulin-associated medication errors. Slide 8, this team had many successes. Regarding glycemic control, the team developed a computer-generated diabetic tracking report of patients with blood sugars over 180, which was automatically printed out to pharmacists and dietary. The computer also generated the patient's current medications. Teams throughout the hospital used these during patient care rounds to evaluate and adjust the patient's current diabetic management. The team developed a continuous insulin infusion protocol for CTICU patients with blood glucose of 90 to 119. The new insulin algorithm included prescribing guidelines for transitioning from intravenous to subcutaneous insulin, as well as a hypoglycemic protocol. Slide 9, regarding patient, family, and staff education, the diabetic patient PI team in-serviced the mid-level practitioners and nursing on evidence-based standards of care, added a consistent carbohydrate diet option for patient meal selections with the room service option, brought in new patient educational materials, including the book Stepping Into Control, and brought diabetic teaching channels onto our patients' TV channels, and used teaching-only glucose meters when teaching patients how to do home glucose monitoring. Slide 10, the diabetic patient PI team also improved house-wide organization and communication regarding diabetic care. They updated the physician order record for glucose control and diabetic flow record, which are attached to this presentation. Developed, standardized, and implemented the nursing policy for the care of the diabetic patient, which I will quickly describe in a moment. Revised the interdisciplinary patient education form to include key educational elements such as survival skills, knowing basic information such as the signs and symptoms of hypoglycemia and how to self-inject insulin. Revised the nutrition assessment form to include hyperglycemia management. Alerted hospital staff that patients are diabetic by placing green signs over the beds and green placemats on food trays. Seeing these signs, staff then checks to see if the patient require any pre-meal blood monitoring and or insulin. Acquired less painful lancets and glucose monitoring strips that required less blood, and updated bedside glucose meters that were more reliable. Slide 11, nursing standard of care for patients with diabetes also assists with increasing compliance with the skip glucose indicator. This standard focuses on assessment of diabetes diagnosis, signs and symptoms, controlling and preventing complications, monitoring fluid volume, having D50 available, documenting bedside blood glucose, lab results, and all insulin on the insulin administration and diabetic flow record, administering medication to control glucose levels, including oral and insulin, providing proper nutrition, providing psychosocial support, maintaining skin integrity and preventing dermal ulcers, and educating patients through first assessing the patient's readiness and ability to learn using the Stepping Into Control education book and following through with the interdisciplinary plan of care, health, and diabetic education plan. Elements of this plan include knowledge of the disease process, medication administration, blood glucose monitoring, hypoglycemia, hyperglycemia nutrition, sick day rules, exercising, and the importance of follow-up visits with physicians and regular visits with the ophthalmologist, dentist, and podiatrist. Slide 12, our SCIP resources include our anesthesiologist, St. Francis Hospital team, glycemic specialists for SCIP glucose measure, including those who are with us today, Dr. Roy Breitbart, Dr. Carol Bono, Joan Wallace, Dr. Chen, the rest of our team, Midas, and of course, Dr. Dale Bratzler and the SCIP blog. Slide 13, attached to this presentation are both the continuous insulin infusion record and the physician order record, continuous insulin infusion delta change protocol. I did not discuss Deming's 14 points again today, but wanted to make sure that everyone knows about the points. These concepts are consistent with what we aim to do with our core measures. We want to build quality into our process, drive out fear so people will talk and do better jobs with leadership support. Concepts from the nursing standard of care were included in one of the slides instead of in a handout. Please let us know if you are interested in learning more about these best practices. And this brings us to our biggest challenge, keeping up with the latest research and literature and striving for the optimal target for glycemic control without inducing hypoglycemia, which is why I included Henry Ford's quote on slide 14. Coming together is a beginning, keeping together is progress, and working together is success. It takes a well-working interdisciplinary team to manage glycemic control and improve patient outcomes. Thank you.
And thank you, Maureen, and to your team. And before we open the lines up for questions and answers, I just wanted to acknowledge St. Francis Hospital as the recipient for the 2009 IPRA Award for Excellence in Performance for the Surgical Care Improvement Project for both the previous eighth scope of work and for the mentorship services that they've been providing for the ninth scope of work. So, again, congratulations, and we thank them for all their work. And I also would just encourage hospitals to strive to achieve the same level of performance and improvement that St. Francis has, as it can be done. And we look forward to acknowledging one or more of our hospitals in the current Ninth Scope of Work SCIP project for their excellent work as well. At this time, Howard, can you please give our audience instructions on how to submit a question?
Please? Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question or comment at this time, please press the 1 key on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Again, if you have a question or comment for the panel at this time, please press star then 1 on your touchtone telephone. Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question or comment at this time, please press star then 1 on your touchtone telephone.
Maureen, I have a question for you and your team. In terms of what some of your experiences may have been before you were able to improve your processes and implement these great protocols, what challenge did you have, if any, regarding the number of infections that your facility may have had that you may possibly had, or were you able to attribute any of your infection rates to problems with serum glucose control?
Hi, this is Joan Wallace. I'm the nurse manager for the cardiothoracic ICU. And when we first initiated the prior algorithm, any patient who came up with any type of sternal wound infection, and it didn't matter if it was deep or not, I would backtrack their initial glucose from pre-admission testing through the ICU, through the med-surg floor, and that was a period of time when we were on the insulin drip and then came off. And as Dr. Breitbart said before and mentioned the sliding scale, I had a smile because that was one of our problems. We went to a sliding scale at that point, and the patient's glucoses would just rebound and become out of control. So I did graphs of those patients with our infectious disease nurse, and we were able to then track the days of their elevated glucoses. So that was a problem for us. And we have been tracking now any sternal wound infections, which have definitely dropped with our glycemic control.
Okay.
Good. I'm showing no audio questions at this time.
Okay. Okay, if we have no further questions, we can go ahead and conclude the call. I just have a couple of updates for everyone. I have three dates that I'm going to ask our participants to mark their calendars for. In the fall, we're going to have a follow-up face-to-face learning session from the kickoff meetings that we had last fall, specifically for the Surgical Care Improvement Project. And we are pleased to announce that our featured speaker for all three meetings will be Dr. Dale Bratzler, who everyone, I'm sure, is familiar with, as he is the national clinical expert for the patient safety theme for the CMS 9 scope of work, including the Surgical Care Improvement Heart Failure Initiative. And we are going to be holding three regional meetings for convenience for all of our hospitals. Locations are to be determined, but If you could still just mark your calendar so you can save the date, and we will continue to bring update information to you over the next few months. They are later on this fall, and I know it's way off, but again, just so you can mark your calendars. The Albany meeting is going to be on Tuesday, October 27th for our hospitals that are in the Albany and Capital District area. Tuesday, November 11th will be the meeting for our downstate hospitals. That's all our hospitals in the metropolitan and Long Island areas. And then we're going to have a third meeting upstate, and that location is still left to be determined. It'll either be in the Rochester or Buffalo areas, and again, we will continue to keep you up to date, but the date for that meeting will be Wednesday, November 11th. We will also be sending you a save the date for our next conference call, and I would just like to remind everyone to please take a few moments to complete the evaluation form that was included in your materials, and in your comments or feedback, please feel free to give us suggestions on any topics of discussion that you would like for subsequent conference calls, as we have actually covered all of the topics included under the SCIP project, with, of course, the exception of the VT indicators, which we have been covering under the webinar series with ARC and Dr. Gregory Maynard. But any other area of topics that are of specific concerns on any of the indicators that are a particular challenge to you, please, by all means, let us know, and we will accommodate you and covering those topics. So, Howard, in the meantime, could we just see if anyone has had a question over the last couple of minutes before we conclude?
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question or comment at this time, please press star, then one on your touch-tone telephone. We have no questions at this time, ma'am.
Thank you, Howard. Okay, so we'll end a little early, which is, I'm sure, okay for a Friday morning. So thank you again for joining us. Enjoy the rest of your day and have a great weekend. Goodbye now.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for participating in today's conference. This concludes the program. You may now disconnect. Everyone have a wonderful day.